Hello and good morning. Welcome to WNHH Radio's Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven and Connecticut tick. Claire Kendall is looking to help make Connecticut tick. She has launched a campaign, not an exploratory campaign, a campaign, to seek the Democratic nomination for Connecticut Attorney General in 2018. That job is open. A lot of lawyers are running for it. It's the people's lawyer, the Attorney General, who's basically runs a 200-member law firm, filing suits and offering opinions and representing state government on behalf of the people of Connecticut. Claire is here in the WNHH studio to update us on her plans, and a special thanks to Yale New Haven Hospital for providing financial support for today's program. Claire Kendall, welcome to WNHH, and thanks for coming on down to New Haven.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so happy to be here.
Chris,
this is great.
From Bloomfield, and
correct,
by way of West Hartford, so you're in that part of the state.
That's right.
What do you know about New Haven compared to being up there? Because my bias is that I think New Haven is a really great place, and the rest of the state's boring as dirt.
Well, then I'll add to it. I'm also from Waterbury.
Oh, okay.
I grew up in Waterbury, so until I went off to college, that's where I've been. I would say New Haven's a fabulous place. Great food, great politics, great amenities.
And great, it's a history of
great
legal
history.
Issues.
Yeah.
So now, Claire, you are the lot of people running for Attorney General already. We had Mike D'Agostino yesterday as an exploratory campaign, William Tong, some others. And you decided to skip the phase of having what's called an exploratory committee.
Correct.
Which lets you raise money for all sorts of offices and use it if you run for something else. You had your mind set. Attorney General, not Treasurer, not Secretary of State, not State Rep. It's this or nothing.
Correct. Absolutely.
And it would seem like one good reason would be is because since 1998, you have been working for the Attorney General's office. You've been working with George Jepson, who's retiring as state. So you've seen them all. You were probably there clearing Artie Riddle or no?
No, I came. I was under Blumenthal.
Okay, Dick Blumenthal.
I was hired by Richard Blumenthal.
So you watched people have sort of a launching pad from AG to bigger things. But have you been the Assistant Attorney General since that time?
That is correct.
So in that job, do you both prosecute? I mean, do you file lawsuits, defend the government, issue advisory opinions, and manage staff? Because that's a big
I do all
a
of
big
it.
Office. 200 lawyers.
Well, I don't manage the 200 lawyers. I have, for the past two decades, been an assistant attorney general, the people's lawyer. I have done a wide variety of issues. For the past 6 years, I have been the department head of the energy unit. So, for example, Rick Perry of the Department of Energy had issued a notice to FERC saying to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, saying, listen, we should subsidize coal and nuclear at the expense of renewables. My unit and myself personally wrote comments to that to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, FERC, saying you should not do that, that is completely contrary to the whole regulatory scheme that's been set up. And
you got voted down by FERC, right?
And it was voted down by FERC, even though four of the FERC commissioners, they that.
Were Republican appointees.
Were Trump appointees.
Yeah, that was interesting.
That was very interesting, but that's something my unit did. The other thing my unit has done is we have is a three-member unit. I have two attorneys that work with me, and we saved over the past 6 years the Connecticut residents over $100 million in electricity costs.
And how'd you do that?
That was a variety of different cases on a regional and national basis with respect to charges by the ISO on their budget.
What's ISO?
I'm sorry.
You're running for office now. It's like
running
FERC
for
and
office,
ISO.
Yes,
you're not
I'm going to have to.
You're not there with the experts in the weeds. Yeah.
Well, and I will say that my experience with the energy area is that they get pretty geeky pretty quickly.
And acronym heavy.
And well, I think every area has their own acronyms.
That's
it's a way.
True.
It's a trade barrier. If you don't know our acronyms, you don't know what we're doing. But the with the Independent Systems Operator of New England is ISO, basically runs the grid, the electricity grid, and they do a really marvelous job, but they're not cheap about how they do a really marvelous job. And so one of the things my office did was held them accountable on their budgeting, because the ISO board is made up of folks who are not elected by the states and by the state residents. It's an independent board that is self-perpetuating, of very highly qualified
really?
People,
mm-hmm.
but there's really no representation on there about who pays their bills.
Claire, were you involved with George Jepson, the Attorney General, on issues related to the sale of United Illuminating to, I know I'm going to say this wrong, Iberdrola, the Spanish energy giant?
I represented Pura on that. I was not on the Jepson side.
Pura being what used to be?
Being the Public Utility Regulatory Authority, which used to be the DPUC.
Right,
correct.
Yeah. And they make decisions. So you were so you were on different sides from your boss?
Yes, actually.
Isn't that so interesting, the way law firms work?
Yes.
So the boss was here, George Jepson, and the reason I'm asking you is this was a big issue in New Haven. Because not only like the rest of the region that we care about how much we're getting charged for energy, so it matters to us who is running the electric company, and we have issues about cutting back trees, and which both sides get argued is pretty interesting.
Yes.
But also specifically in New Haven, there was this mothballed former Sooty 6, quote unquote, polluting plant called English Station that United Limited had never cleaned up and was trying to evade responsibility for it. And George Jepson actually was hailed as a hero in New Haven because he succeeded as a part of this much bigger multi-billion dollar transaction with international company, got in there in New Haven rule before it got approved, which is that they're going to have to clean up that plant, and it started. But you were on a different, not against, but on a different side of that.
Correct.
A transaction which was representing the PUR, which is the Public Utility Regulatory Agency.
The Public Utility Public Utilities Regulatory Authority.
And so what was your job in advising them?
Well, I did not advise the Attorney General on that. Though if I was the Attorney General, if I am successful in my quest to become the Attorney General, I would have done just what Attorney General Jepson did, which is step in on those types of transactions and make sure that the people of Connecticut are protected. Here we're going to get a little into the weeds.
That's good.
Okay.
We're just going to spell out acronyms on first reference. That's all.
We'll spell them out. What the Attorney General's office has a statutory obligation to be the lawyer for the state and for the people of the state of Connecticut. And so as part of that, the Attorney General has a right, is required to represent the Public Utility Regulatory Authority in any of their decision making, and anything appeals from their decisions. So the there are attorneys, my unit, that are represent PURA and also represent the state and PURA in national and regional issues. So any sort of appeals taken from PURA actions, that's what we handle. The Attorney General separately has some statutory authority to intervene in utility cases to represent the people of Connecticut and their interests, very similar to Ellen Katz, the Consumer Counsel. So they have similar roles, so different statutory authority for it. And so there's what's known as a Chinese wall.
So you can't have any meetings with your boss if your job is representing PURA and his job is representing people who are upset with PURA.
Who are upset with PURA, correct. And so in that role, I reported to an associate attorney general who was responsible for monitoring what I was doing on my half of those issues, whereas the attorney general was on the other side of it.
So
I've been out on unpaid leave since December 8th, so I'm not a current AAG.
And you've been on leave because you're running for the Democratic nomination for attorney general. Claire, you've been 20 years.
20 years.
Working in the Attorney General's office as a staffer. You didn't have to play politics. You didn't have to give speeches. You didn't have to go around the state looking for votes. You didn't have to think when you were filing a case whether certain constituencies may like it or not like it when they decide whether to vote for you in 4 years. Why are you making that change? Everybody else running for this office, whom I'm familiar with at least, has run for elected office before. They're politicians. And that doesn't mean to smear them. I'm not saying it's bad to be a politician. I think it depends what kind of politician you are, like anything else. Why are you deciding to go from a career attorney working on policy and lawsuits to actually seeking elected office to run that operation?
I have been in elected office for 9 years in West Hartford. I was 5 years on the Board of Ed, 4 years on the town council.
Okay.
My last term ended in 2015, and I really didn't think I'd run again. I did that, you know, as well as working full time in the Attorney General's office. It was sort of
a busy life.
It was
you have kids growing up.
I do. I have one son, and I'm also married. And you know, my son has just turned 22 last week.
I always wonder that about people who do go into public life like that. How much you sacrifice being with your family? I mean, it's not something I'd be willing to do.
Yeah. Well, it was. You know, there is the. I like to be busy. And they say you want something done, ask a busy person.
So then I was wrong. You are familiar with running for office. It's not like this something's anathema to you. But why do you want to run for this office when you've been doing the work behind the scenes?
Right. Like a lot of people, I went to the Women's March in D.C.
Oh, you did?
Last year.
That was the inauguration.
Right after the inauguration. And joined, you know, hundreds of thousands of men and women.
Now, internationally, I think it was the biggest demonstration in history, wasn't it?
I believe so. Depending on, you know, who's measuring it.
According to Trump, his inauguration had the biggest crowd in the history of the planet.
Yeah, right, exactly. Sorry about that.
That was a fact. Sorry.
And so... And we all went for it because we were very concerned about the results of the election. I mean, people were there because they were very worried about where our nation was going. And over this past year, I have continued to be increasingly concerned about where our nation is going and what is coming out of Washington, and have really looked for a way to make a difference, to pitch in, to lean in, to how, whatever term you want, you know, to make a difference, to say, this isn't right.
That was the big question coming off the Women's March, when there was this outpouring of energy and concern among women across the country about our political system and how they claim they can get involved. Those demonstrations, no matter what the subject, often dissipate afterwards, that energy, and they don't get followed up. Now, since that demonstration, we've had the rise of the Me Too movement, in which the role of men in power is being questioned, the misuse, and that women are stepping up for a second reason. Do you think there's going to be follow through? Are women going to start taking their place at the table? Are more women going to be running for public office in a significant way to really challenge the way that we've been running our institutions?
I believe that that's happening now, but let me finish the last question, because I probably was a little too long-winded with it. When the Attorney General called me, you know, the Monday after Thanksgiving, and saying, I'm not going to run, and then it became public an hour later. I was shocked. I'll be honest with you.
Because he loves the job.
He loves the job.
And I do believe there's a reason we don't know. I don't believe it's just that he wants time with his family. I've never seen a guy enjoy a job as much as he does, and he's been very successful at it.
Right.
So, yeah.
But in many ways, I said, okay. I sat and looked at my office for a week and said, and then I spent the next week saying, you know what? We're going to wrap it up. And this allows me to make a difference and to continue in a job I love, which is being the people's lawyer.
But you could continue that job without running.
I could certainly continue that job without running.
So why run?
Because I can make a difference. Because that office, I walk in that office and it's running on all cylinders on day one. There's no training wheels. I know what that office does, but I know what that office doesn't do. And I know that that office has really needed to step up when the federal government has abandoned long-standing priorities of this nation, like environment, energy, consumer protection, antitrust, labor. And on all of those areas, the state attorney generals have had to step up, whereas, you know, and basically fill a spot where the federal government has really abandoned it. So, and also the state's attorney generals have had to take in a very affirmative step. So not only have they stepped up where the federal government has created a void, but they've also had to serve as a line of defense on issues such as immigration, there's a lot of national issues.
Offshore drilling.
Also, I mean, it keeps you. In some ways, you get numb to it, and I think that's where I said I can't be numb to this.
Let me see if I'm putting words in your mouth. So I'm a male, so I can't answer this question from personal experience. After the millions of women across the world, especially in the country, not just D.C., the Women's March,
they did,
and then have spoken up in Me Too, is this a time in our history when every woman who has some connection to public life or potential causes says, personally, do I have to step up? If this is going to happen, I have to decide when my moment is.
I could not reasonably ask the younger generation, my son's generation, to say step up when the most qualified woman who with experience in public office, in elected office, did not step up and say, I can run for this. I would be the best attorney general. It's very easy. We all have our lives. You know, it's much easier to, deal with our everyday lives, whatever makes us happy. But here I can make a big difference. I know what this office does. I've done it. I've brought consumer protection cases. I've brought environmental enforcement cases. You know, I've brought antitrust cases. I have defended cases where the state has been sued. I know what that means. I know what the office does. And I believe I'll be the best at it.
And I believe that you might want to be reminded, listen to Dateline New Haven on WNHHFM, your home for community radio 103.5, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. We're talking to Claire Kendall. She's seeking the Democratic nomination for the Attorney General's office this year. It's open. George Jepson, her boss, is retiring. She's been an assistant AG since 1998, saved on antitrust cases. Help me understand Amazon. Is that an antitrust disaster? Is there some role we should be playing here? Or do we have to rethink? Because we've been rethinking what antitrust is, for instance, as disruptive technologies have changed every industry. So, for instance, I'm in media. I'm no longer worried if a TV station owns a newspaper or not in the area, because there's so many other kinds of media that's no longer the monopoly voice. But I worried a lot about it 20 years ago. Amazon has completely disrupted how we do retail in a lot of ways, whether it's taxation issues about where stuff originates or whether they can have uncompetitive practices that, remember the whole fight with the hatchet book publishers about how you market. Is Amazon on your radar? How do we think of that as an antitrust
issue? I have to say that Amazon and Google, I mean, there's some very large players in that market. And for any antitrust case, it's what are the barriers to market entrance? And if you have only one player in a market, well, then you have to worry about, you have to worry about monopoly.
Or if you have an infinite number of players with an industry with a long tail, but one of them has like Google dominating search or.
Correct. But which is why Google's gotten into trouble with that.
All right, in Europe, they're being much tougher on Google in America. I think we have more of a tradition of believing in the private market. It'll settle itself out and the abilities of people to disrupt. And so some people have argued that, in fact, all the innovations, whether it was Uber or other kinds of tech companies that come up, in fact, do challenge Microsoft and others. And yes, they eventually buy them or try to put them out of business, but that it's still possible to continually innovate, whereas others feel like GAF or whatever you want to call them these days, because they've changed Google after the acronym for the big players, Google, Apple, Amazon, Facebook. Whether they just have too much of a market share, there's no turning back. Is our big issue on antitrust, therefore, net neutrality and the recent decision by the Federal Communications Commission to allow tolls on the information superhighway? Is that the different way to think about it?
I think there's a lot of different ways to think about it. And there's certainly, think about IBM. Everybody was worried about IBM, having all of the market power, and there certainly has been an explosion in technology.
Microsoft.
One needs to take a look at the facts of each specific case, balance it, investigate it, analyze it.
But like as an attorney general, for instance, you know that an immigration, I'm looking at what you've said elsewhere and others, you don't like the federal government's policy very specifically, and that you'd want to fight that. Is there a specific, and it's okay if the answer is no, is there a specific way of looking at antitrust or consumer protection, for instance, with the what's going to be the decimation of the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau? Is there a similar clear cut, or is it too simplistic to put it that way of looking at antitrust moving forward after 2018 that you will be tackling as Attorney General?
I'm not sure I'm getting what you're getting at, but let me tell you where I'm coming from.
Simply said environment is threatened by these policies and we have to
go for it. I mean, absolutely.
What is at stake with antitrust?
Okay. With antitrust, is actually a lot at stake. The federal government has broad antitrust powers, but so does the state. And in fact, the state attorney general can bring her own antitrust case without going anywhere else. They can just investigate it and bring it, as long as there's a connection to the state. And so that's actually a very powerful role of the Attorney General, is to bring antitrust cases. They have their own statutory power to bring a state antitrust case. And in the federal government, this federal government has stepped back. Now, whether net neutrality is an antitrust violation, I think there certainly is unfair trade practices. There may be antitrust. There's a lot of tools in the toolbox for an Attorney General to do to take on issues of net neutrality. Or of
well, do you agree with the FCC commission? Because some people say it's over, the worries are overblown and the market will work it out.
Well, I would say if you speak to anybody under 35, that they would tell you that this is really a very big deal. But I also agree with them that there are no checks. And I'm always very concerned when there's no checks and balances in any situation. So the telecom companies are saying, well, competition will take care of it. And if competition doesn't take care of it, then the FTC will take care of it, or consumers can bring complaints. Well, there's mandatory arbitration clauses and class action waivers, and the FTC is not stepping up. And so why would, I don't think there are any checks. It'll be very interesting to see how it rolls out. And depending on how it is implemented, there may be a need for the state AGs to step up, and there's a lot of tools state AGs have to do that, and I would absolutely do it. My son is 22 and is completely fanatical on this issue, and I will say give a shout out to Ellen Swanson Katz, who's done some great work on this issue.
Now, Claire Kendall, you alluded earlier, and you just said AGs plural. A lot of times, the power the states have lies in attorneys general from different states banding together to sue. We learned that a generation ago. You were probably in the office at the time of the tobacco lawsuit.
Absolutely.
And that just last year alone, you have an office with a $30 million budget. It brought in $636 million.
Yes.
So basically, we spent $30 million on your office and got 20 times that amount of money back from lawsuits that you file with other attorneys general. If I'm not mistaken, from what I read up on you, you've done some of those. You've worked with
them.
You've been the person with people in working with attorneys general's offices in other states to sue pharmaceutical companies,
correct?
Telecoms,
yep.
Banks, and polluters. Tell us about one of those cases and what you learned about what works and what doesn't work when an attorney general's office wants to take on a big national issue for consumer protection.
Let me take on the telecom one, but I could talk about all of them. Quest had a problem with their marketing, and they were doing what was known as slamming. It was a time when it was valuable to who was your customers, and they were involuntarily transferring customers without the customer's permission. So,
what does Quest do?
Quest was a telecommunication company. I'm not even sure if it's in existence anymore, but it was one that was doing.
Did you buy your phone from them or your landline service?
Your landline
cable?
Service.
Okay.
It was your landline service.
Because I don't even understand now when I look at it, what used to be SBC and AT&T and Frontier.
And Comcast and Frontier.
I don't quite know who gives you what, yeah.
Right. And so Quest was one of those players. And they would come in and they would tell the main telephone company, listen, switch them over to me. I've got their long-distance service and local service, and then they would charge them a lot more money, and they didn't have the customer's permission. And that was a case that was a very large case, and it actually settled for a substantial amount of money, but it was a case where you had, hundreds of boxes of documents, and if you have multiple different AG states, and this was before we had as much sort of global, cloud-based data management. Which AGs are going to look at what, mm-hmm. and who's got information about this, and how are we going to work it? It was one of those cases where you say, okay, you take the lead. So there's a lot of cases where Connecticut takes the lead, and there's a lot of cases where New York takes the lead,
and in every state working with is a political office where someone wants the credit. So how do you work that out? Like how do you get Eric Schneiderman's people to say he doesn't get the big headline on this one? We do.
I think that's the least of the concerns, really. I mean, the primary concern is what can we do that makes things best for the people of Connecticut?
I wonder if having women leadership in the job will actually change the way that dynamic works.
That, I don't know, but it'd be nice to find out.
Anything you learned from one of these cases about the pitfalls of working or challenges of working with other attorneys general to take on the federal government or a big industry, multinational corporation? What?
Elections.
Oh.
Elections. You are going along on a case, and then there is a major change in leadership.
Are you generally working with Democrats?
In this era, yes, but not always. There's a lot of NAG is a wonderful organization, which is the National Associations of Attorney General. I'm learning, and they have a wonderful system to put out issues for all 50 states.
It was interesting to me to watch the secretaries of the state. So Denise Merrill, our secretary of state, is in charge of the national organization, which have whatever acronym it has for secretary of state. And when they were fighting back against President Trump's supposed voter fraud commission,
right.
That was equally Democratic and Republican. That was powerful. And you saw people on TV, Republican attorneys, or secretaries of state telling the Trump administration, come and get us. You're not getting these records. We're not turning these voter files over to
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely. Isn't it great?
Yeah,
and you get the same thing on the attorney general side, and in fact,
sometimes with corporate power, right? It's not like GAFA or the big tech companies are beloved by the Tea Party.
Correct. Well, there's a lot of. I mean, it's rare that you're going to get something with 50 states, but there's mm-hmm. a lot of cases where we have multiple states of 20, 30 states across the country who say, "Yes, I care about this issue, and I'll sign on to that brief."
For now, it does appear that immigration is one of those partisan issues.
Correct.
If you're elected, now Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General, has made it clear in recent days that the Trump administration has not forgotten about seeking to take money away from states that consider themselves sanctuary cities or states, meaning they do not comply with the requests for federal detention orders on people who are accused of nonviolent crimes. We're not posing a danger to the public. They don't agree to hold them more. And that what are you going to do on this issue if you're elected?
I'm going to continue what's happening now, and I'm going to bring every lawsuit I can. Now, states' attorneys general don't make immigration policy.
But they are suing about the immigration.
But you can fight about how it's implemented, and you can fight about its impact. And they are successfully suing on immigration, on these immigration policy changes. Mm-hmm. And I would absolutely continue it. I would fight for sanctuary cities. I think that it's abhorrent that immigrants are being arrested in courthouses and schools and police stations. And I would do everything to prevent that because it's a public safety issue. If an immigrant can't safely go to school, to a police officer, or to a courthouse without worrying about being deported, then you have a victimization risk that is so much higher because there's nowhere to report it. So you then have the detriments of that, and the dangers of that are just so real and stark that you have to fight it everywhere.
You're listening to Claire Kendall, who is a declared candidate for Attorney General as a Democrat running in 2018 in Connecticut. She's here on Dateline New Haven and WNHH FM, your home for community radio at 103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. You've been for 20 years an assistant attorney general. You work for George Jepson, who's retiring.
Correct.
Do you offer yourself as a candidate who's going to continue the policies of George Jepson? Do you agree with him in general? Do you see changes in the office, or do you want to continue the course and build on it?
I would continue his course and build on it. I think that he's done an outstanding job. And I certainly, on the national level, on the environment, on energy, on antitrust, on labor, all of those national issues, I'm completely in accord with the Attorney General. Though I do have a couple of issues that are, I would emphasize that I don't know he has emphasized quite as much. One of them for me is education, student loan debt. I think that we have indentured our youth. I think that student loan debt is death. It is. I think it's a real societal crisis.
What can the Attorney General do about it?
The Attorney General can educate, advocate, and protect.
Does that mean you sue the companies to change their practices? Does it mean you do public education campaigns, which I don't know if that's part of a lawyer's office or not? What is it that you do?
You would certainly, first of all, make sure that students understand their rights with student loan debt and what can and can't be done.
And why is that the job of AG rather than Consumer Counsel or Higher Education Department?
Because of the next two steps, I would say. Because I would advocate to change the law that I think student loan debt should be dischargeable in bankruptcy under certain circumstances. And right now it's not. And I understand why it wasn't many, many years ago. But right now, student loan companies are getting market rates and they have no risk because students can't discharge those debts in bankruptcy. And so they're indentured for 20 years, 30 years, and they can never get rid of it. They can never get out from under, and that's not right. And then the third is to protect. There's a lot of unscrupulous predatory lenders. There are some educational institutions that basically churn students through, get them with very high debt, and these students never get their degrees. And there's a lot of things that the Attorney General has done and can do to make that. And so that's one of my emphasis is student loan debt. The other one is the do not call list.
Oh, God. No, that is just, it's no longer working. I mean, we get all those calls from people these companies that they trick you by getting the suffix of your phone number to come on your cell phone.
Correct.
To answer.
This is
an article about these companies have started up where they can automatically, they have a big database, they can often figure out that download this app, they figure out you're getting the call, and then they have some program that answers it and keeps them on the line for a long time. And they've been trying all these routines. I've been trying. It hasn't worked after reading the article. One was this Jerry Seinfeld line where the guy says, you get this call and you say, hey, I'm busy right now. Can I call you back a little later at home? And the guy says, no. He says, well, what makes you think I'm going to be called at home? Or the other thing is you keep them on the line by just talking to them and playing with them. So you'll say, one guy who was quoting saying, you just keep talking. There's a bee that's going up my arm. I don't want to disturb them. They keep just like saying yes, no, no matter what they're saying. It makes no sense of what they're saying. But I don't know if that's the most effective way. It sounds like you think the attorney general might have some better tools.
I think that this is something that's a national issue. There may be something you can do in the state, but I also think this is an opportunity to work with the telecom companies because it doesn't help them either. And if somebody came to your door at your home and knocked on the door 10 times a day, bang, 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 let me in, let me in, let me in, you would have the right to put up a sign at your gate and say, no trespassing, no soliciting, don't come in, so that you didn't have somebody banging at your door 10 times a day. Mm-hmm. I believe that consumers should have that same right on their telephone to say, I don't want robocalls unless it's for public safety, and I don't, no trespassing, no soliciting. And I think it's a technology fix. I think it's a software fix. I think that there has to be a way for consumers to say, no, I don't want those calls. But to take it a step further, I think there has to be a way for telecom companies to say, we shouldn't have, it's a small amount of the bad actors in the market that are doing this.
But they're all over the world and hard to trace, right?
Well, why can't we just turn them off? Why can't all of these telecommunication companies,
don't they have to figure out, take them off? Which are there, because they're constantly chaining what the numbers look like, right? And where you're coming from, you don't even know if the calls come from the Philippines or Estonia or Maine.
Or Meriden. I seem to get a lot of calls from Bristol, Connecticut. You know, no offense, Bristol.
So in terms of tech fix, are there legal tools you can use to insist on that tech fix?
I believe so, and I also believe there's an advocacy of tools across the nation. I think this is one of those nonpartisan ones where
I saw that article was the Weekly Standard, which is a conservative paper.
I think the attorney generals across the country would, if you want to change policy, be in the legislature and change policy. If you want to, you know, act as a lawyer and an advocate, there's places you act as advocates and places where you act and give advice.
I think there's a really fundamental, honest debate about law and the nature of law. And we see it with religious law and constitutional law.
True.
And, you know, so when John Roberts was being confirmed as U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice, he said, I call balls and strikes, what it said in the Constitution. So people on the Democratic side or liberal side said, that's BS. You really have just like the other side, have the end you want to get to. But you're dressing it up as this is what the founders thought, when in fact they were writing Constitution at a different time when the world has changed. And that in fact it's a legitimate exercise, as long as you're intellectually honest, to find the basis in law to support the end you want. But they'll come back and say that's too fungible, that law, we're a nation of laws and not, you say men, laws and not people, and that we have to believe that even though law does evolve over time, we do have to look at original intent and change it slowly and have that be above what we think is right at the time. So for instance, you know, liberals believed in states' rights when the federal government needed to desegregate schools. Now, they were against state rights then, the conservatives are for it. Now conservatives are against state rights when they want marijuana not to be legal, whereas liberals are for it, so you get experimentation. Is there a danger as AG, not the same thing as a judge, acting in your advisory role, is there a danger that you will not be fulfilling your mission if you're trying to have the outcome on marijuana or collective bargaining? Because D'Agostino's point was, we're in danger of becoming Wisconsin. There's an assault on rights of labor. There's plenty in law to support it. We can't be giving advisory opinions that help Republicans overturn it.
And yet Republicans didn't overturn it. Mm-hmm. And the legislature did their job, and the attorney general did his job.
How about our marijuana? Are you, for instance, do you support legalization of marijuana?
I support if I was in the legislature, I would support the legalization of marijuana. As an attorney general, I would vigorously defend the legislature's passing of the legalization of marijuana, and I would certainly defend the laws that are already on the book with respect to marijuana.
Now, you'd be giving an advisory opinion, if I'm not mistaken. Please, I'm not an expert, so tell me if I'm wrong.
All right.
You'll probably, if they pass, you'll have to give an advisory opinion about if the Trump administration crackdown continues, whether you're going to have a legal problem in terms of interstate commerce laws that will stop that industry from running. You will give an opinion that can affect the outcome of how legislature votes. And it might, by saying about the practical barriers, like if we're going to say we're going to bring in $500 million a year, whatever they're going to say it's going to be on Iran revenue, you might have an opinion saying that might not be true because we're going to have to argue that the federal government doesn't have a right to limit to make more arrests or limit commerce. How do you give that opinion? Again, is this another case where you try to give an opinion that gives them the basis to fight the federal government, or to give them an advice that might help them come out to an outcome you don't agree with?
First of all, there's going to be a whole lot of lawsuits. It's a legal a lawyer's job security act by doing that. You know that there's going to be a fight with the federal government, one way or the other, and so you really can't avoid that fight. So if asked, if asked for opinion saying, "Oh no, there isn't any problem," electing an attorney general is hiring a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
You don't ask for a lawyer to give you the answer you want. You ask for a lawyer to say, "I will advocate strongly for the answer you want, but you need to know there's risks." So you want a lawyer who's going to give you the straight story and is going to give you honest legal opinions. Now, if you are worried about getting an honest legal opinion, then don't ask for the opinion. but if you want, that's a different thing. Again, advisory opinions are so small of what we do. We do a lot of advocacy. We mostly do advocacy. And we fight federal government all the time and on their intrusion on the state's laws. For example, the concealed carry permit that they want to say go to the lowest common denominator across the country. That's, all kinds of advocacy and all kinds of reasons why that is just abhorrent, and a health and safety reason and a police power, and this federal government can't do that. And you bring all of your lawsuits, and that is like 98% of what we do we're in court either defending or bringing suits. So that is, really what we do for, our day in and day out bread and butter. But if your experience with your office is only advisory opinions, well, then that's what you would focus on.
Mm-hmm. Can I hit you with a third one?
Of course, you can hit me without your like.
Claire Kendall, who's running for the Attorney General's Democratic nomination for Attorney General. Another issue in which we dealt with this one of your opponents was school funding.
Mm-hmm.
So a state judge whose names I always mispronounce, Thomas Malkusher.
McCousher.
One day I'll get that.
That's all right.
He had a landmark ruling that the way we fund our schools is unconstitutional. And sort of to prove him right, the legislature continued not to really change the formula this year. So George Jepson, the attorney general, issued an opinion that said that the judge overreached in several key ways.
Mm-hmm.
And he also fought the decision. He wanted the decision overturned. One of your opponents, Mike D'Agostino, we then came back to the position of the attorney general should be looking at what the law is right or the outcome you want, and whether those are different questions or not. He said that while he agrees that certain parts of her overreaching, certain weren't, that it was important that the state not fight the judge's decision because the judge was basically right that the legislature should change this. And he said he would have advised the legislature and the governor that he did not want to represent the state to fight the judge's decision. That's a tough one because you're the lawyer for the government. You're in an advocacy role. You also might conclude that the judge was right or partly wrong, partly right. Do you agree with Jepson that he had to, with intellectual honesty or taking his role the right way, because he was in here talking about this, he said, "I had to be intellectually honest and look what my role is," that he had no choice but to say, "I'm going to fight the judge's decision, I'm going to appeal it"? Or do you agree with your opponent, Mike D'Agostino, that you could have still done your job right, acknowledge the way the judge is overreached, but pushed not to tell your client, "I don't want to represent you on this because I feel like the judge is overall right and this needs to change"?
Connecticut General Statute 3-125 says the Attorney General shall represent the interests of the states and shall defend the state's laws. And until the state's laws are changed, it is the statutory and fiduciary obligation of the Attorney General to defend those laws. And a decision came out, and unless you appeal it, you can't change it. So saying, "Well, listen, I think that the legislature should act on this." I think the legislature should act on it. Get on to it. Move.
But the argument is whether the judge can make them do it or not.
Right? Well, and there's a lot of very technical issues about that. Is this a matter that really belongs in this legislature? Or do we want education policy in this state decided by one person with a black robe.
And that gets back to civil rights, where people say there comes a point where under the Constitution, the legislature has failed. So that's part of the separation of powers. But then on the other side, the argument is you can't pick that. It's a slippery slope, and you'll just be invoking that every time you don't like a result, and you will give a judge too much power. Then the third argument is that even if you think it's being violated, that long term, you're not going to have meaningful change if the people don't buy into the democratic process of legislature. But on the other hand, then other people say we're a nation of laws and constitution, and therefore, if the judge doesn't sometimes step in, it'll never change.
Yes.
But you're saying your client, because you said the statute says you have to represent the interests of the people and the government. Mm-hmm. Isn't it fungible, the definition of who that is?
And it can be a very tricky line to dance.
So is it
sometimes.
If Dan Malloy, or whoever the governor is, it might be Republican if you're the attorney general. Mm-hmm. If the Republican tells you this is what the people's interest in the government is, go fight the judge on school desegregation or marijuana or whatever. Or is the people's interest the majority in the legislature? Or is it the people you took a poll on or people you happen to agree with? How do you decide who your client is?
Well, that's actually easier than you think, for your hypothetical. The laws of the state of Connecticut are passed by the legislature and signed by the governor, whether they are Democrat or Republicans. And it is the attorney general's, unless that law is unconstitutional, unless it feels that it really is so clearly, blatantly unconstitutional, the attorney general has a statutory and fiduciary obligation to enforce those laws.
But isn't this the case here? Isn't this calling the question on the school decision? Isn't it the judge has said this is unconstitutional? He's not the final authority judge, right? Mm-hmm. There's an appellate process. But what if who's the client? You're saying it's whether the law was passed and had to be signed by both,
Yes.
But how do we decide in this case where a judge has said you've broken the Constitution?
Right.
And the governor doesn't think so, but some legislators think he's right. How do you decide here?
You let the highest court in the land decide.
But you're still taking a stand. When you appeal it, you're asking the highest court in the land to rule against the judge.
Yes, you are.
But you're
making it sound like it's an all or nothing thing, and it's not. So there's a lot of judgment, and the ultimate decision about what the legal position is rests by statute with the attorney general. And so that decision, which was, I don't envy Judge McCousher. I mean, it was a terrible issues to have to deal with.
Budget by taking money from Bridgeport for schools and giving it to Westport, something's broken.
Correct. Absolutely. And, the legislature has had, I was on the Board of Ed from West Hartford for 5 years and, 2 years as its chair. And we were always wildly underfunded under the ECF funding. I mean, there's, the educational cost share funding. But that said, there's a lot of judgment that goes into what is argued, even when you bring in appeals, saying, listen, you also can't balance this budget and fund education on the backs of special ed kids. There are real issues that way as well.
The bottom line is this is pretty fun and pretty important to parse out.
It's wonderful.
So Claire Kendall, you're running for job, or you can do that day and night.
I certainly am.
You are running for the Democratic nomination of Attorney General.
Yes.
In an office you've worked for 20 years. Right. Inspired by the Women's March on Washington to step up.
Yes, it is.
All right, thank you so much for coming in the WNHA studio and giving us a glimpse of both the experience you have in the job and the way you want to tackle it if elected.
Thank you very much. And come learn more at www.clairekindle.com.
All right, so you got whole web thing going.
I do. I certainly do. And Facebook.
And net neutrality has not pushed you out of the picture.
Not yet, but as soon as I hear this interview, who knows?
Thank you for joining us. I wanted to give a special thanks to Yale New Haven Hospital for providing support for today's program. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD A Plea for Peace. Now we know what it's like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book your flight with us all day and all night long here at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.